Well, thank you very much for having me here. This has already been an amazing discussion, a lot of fun hearing about things very different from my everyday experience as an X-ray observer. So I'm going to try to bring us to some more data and in mass, down in mass a little bit from Avery to the stellar mass systems. And since I know many of you work on diverse things, I'm going to first talk just a little bit about X-ray binaries, the sorts of environments that the black holes live in that I'm describing, and then tell you quickly how we measure mass and really focus on how we go about measuring spin for these black hole systems. So this is a cartoon showing you characteristically what these X-ray binaries look like. So there's some 10 million kilometers roughly between the star and the black hole. Some of these stars may be losing lots of their mass by strong winds. Others, and in fact, most of the ones we study, are overflowing a Roche lobe. So they're sort of tidally sheared out and funneling matter into a disk. And then only in the inner 100 kilometers or so around the disk do you actually see X-ray emission. So something like 90% of the X-ray emission is within some very small unresolved region, which is just a few tens, hundreds of RG. And it can outshine the sun by about a millionfold and in X-rays. So these are very very compact, very bright emitters in our galaxy. In fact, some of the brightest objects in our galaxy. And we think that any black hole that goes off, that goes bang in the night, we will detect it because they're just so bright in the Milky Way.
Question, is it a unique channel that will give rise to these binary?
No, there are a few channels that can give rise to these. So there's usually the sort of favored picture for how you get one of these binary systems is there's a relatively close binary evolution that goes through some common envelope phase where as say this companion or the black hole initially expands into a red giant phase, the companion star will swoop in, shear off some of the outer layers, and it brings the whole binary system closer. So that's the usual formation scenario, but there are also captures and exchanges, especially in cluster environments. You can have a lot more rich dynamics that give rise to these sorts of binary systems.
If you replace black hole with a neutron star, how much picture changes?
It's very similar formation scenario. So yeah.
What you see is pretty similar.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, a lot of the systems that could form black holes in a common envelope phase can sort of get enough mass loss that they end up just forming a neutron star at the end. So a lot of similar progenitors to both systems. And I'd say we know sort of common envelope models are very loose. So there's a lot of knob turning that can just little tweaks can very dramatically adjust the end result. So the efficiency by which you have exchange in these systems, the structure of the outer layers, for those common envelopes. So yeah, there's a lot to tune there and how long that phase lasts. So just to orient us, this is an OB association. So some very massive stars that tend to form in large clusters. This is just one example from our galaxy. And in this cluster alone, there are probably some 100 or so stellar mass black hole systems. And by comparison, we think there's maybe 100 million stellar mass black holes in the galaxy. Very roughly, we don't have strong constraints on that.
100, not in binaries, just 100.
That's right. Not in binaries, but just 100 stellar mass black holes lurking around somewhere in this image. But we only know of about 50, if you're very, very generous, close to 100 in our own galaxy. And that's because we need them to be in these binary systems in order to detect them at all. So there have been a lot of searches to try to find quiescent stellar mass black holes by other means, but to skip to the punchline of that, they've been largely unsuccessful. So
could you see how that number, the 100 million number, what is the assumption?
So yeah, this depends very much on sort of, you know, like Woosley models for supernova explosions and so on. So it depends on the IMF, the initial mass function for stars, how readily stars of a given mass are likely to collapse, form black holes directly, and it depends on how many of them are in binaries and how those binary exchange mechanisms go into forming black holes.
Stars are in binary. So does the fact that the number of black holes, of known black holes, it's orders of magnitude smaller than the number of estimated black holes, can that be used to put a constraint on the kick of supernova explosion? Has anyone done that?
Sorry, say that one more time.
As the fact that the number of these of the black holes you have in the slide, it's orders of magnitude smaller than the number of black holes available, most of which probably were born in binary when they were stars.
Yeah.
That tells you that the binary was disrupted, which tells you something about the kick of the during the supernova, right? How much?
Well, so there are other things that go into it too. So what is the duty cycle between outbursts? So most of the black holes that we know about are transients. So in fact, all of them but these top few are transients. So they have very long-lived quiescent periods. And probably what we see is only the most compact of these binary systems. There are probably many other wider binaries that we don't detect and might only detect, you know, once in a million years. And they're just, you know, many fewer of them that we've observed. So, we detect binary systems that are closely interacting and have regular outbursts. Regular meaning something like 10 years to maybe 1,000 years. Many of these we've only seen go off once. In fact, most of them. So there are a lot of probably selection effects that go into what black hole systems actually outburst. But also, if you knew enough in principle, these are coupled problems. But if you lose more than half the mass in your supernova, then obviously that unbinds the binary. So it's complicated, I guess, is the punchline.
But is there any obvious bias? Suppose one of these were black hole. For whatever reason, I'm going to choose 30 solar masses.
Mm-hmm. For no reason.
Would you have a particular scenario to explain why a star orbiting a black hole that massive would not shine? What were there some bias in your observation that would just say these guys are not there?
To have a hidden 30
mass black hole.
I think if I can rephrase this question, is why X-ray binaries have never found black holes of the masses of LIGO found?
Oh yeah, that's a wonderful question. I want to know also. Yeah.
You don't have any selection bias. There's nothing that would say you guys wouldn't see that.
Yeah, I think that's right. Any black hole in that went off in our galaxy. In fact, even including very local neighborhood, the LMC and SMC, we would certainly detect by sort of the all sky surveys.
Could it be that the formation mechanism is just different? Because those merge in the age of the universe, right? All the systems that you observe, would any of them merge in the age of the universe?
That's a good question. I don't know offhand the timescales for these to merge. Right now, most of these are dominated. They're I guess by LIGO standards, they're very long period systems. So I think the shortest is just about 4 hours for these. So I don't know the time scale it takes for that to merge.
Is outside the LISA band, right? So
I think the answer is they're very rare, and you couple that with the need for a fuel supply, and you know we've been observing these things for what 40 years.
Yeah.
I mean, you put the two together, and you're just the chances of seeing something like that are pretty low. 30 solar masses was a big surprise.
Yeah, it was. I mean,
these things are much smaller.
Yeah, the largest mass that we've measured otherwise is about 16 solar masses. So,
Nobody surprised for a black hole binary system like LIGO detected.
Well, they're seeing much further.
It's a big volume.
Volume. Compensating that way.
But in terms of density, even if you expand your volume, wouldn't you expect that your largest probabilities to find lower masses?
No. No, because larger masses, if you reduce the mass, then the strain also pays a price. So now the effective volume is much smaller.
Okay.
So I can hand wave for a moment and speak really a bit beyond my knowledge, but it is the case that if you go to earlier universe, lower metallicities, you expect characteristically larger black holes to be formed. And also, if you look at in cluster environments, most of the black holes that we see here are not. In fact, none of these are in cluster environments. They're all sort of diffused around. There's been a big search to find black holes in globular clusters, and they've, by and large, turned up empty. So if we're finding gravitational waves from these merging systems that do survive in clusters, they might be sort of a characteristically different population than we're probing. But this is, again, you know, this is hand waving, not rigorous, just sort of thoughts.
I mean, you know, the Eddington luminosity for a solar mass object is about 10 to the 38.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got 30 times that. It's still pretty faint if you go out to a large enough distance. So it's not a trivial thing to see in X-rays.
Yeah, that's right. So I guess the last thing I wanted to say about this picture is this is actually concrete knowledge. These are the binary systems that you know, if you talk to an X-ray observer, they will know these systems by name. Some they will love, some they will hate. They're you know, richness of behavior from all of these systems, and many of them have been active for many months at a time or years at a time, and some of them have shown recurrence. But what's encoded on this diagram is actually the real binary separations, the temperature of the star, the physical distortion, the orientation of the disk. So this is all real information that we have about these systems, about 20 that we really have the dynamics well constrained for the black hole binaries. And what we see in the X-ray domain, where we're really looking at accretion, is variability structure that looks like this. So this is 16 years of observations with the Rossi X-ray Timing Explorer all compressed into one image for you, showing the landscape of black hole behavior in our galaxy. So this is in detector units. I'm not showing you luminosities here. I'm showing you detected brightness. And this hardness is a proxy that I'll sort of return to later in the talk. This is basically showing you something about an accretion state, an accretion mode for the source. So over here, this is states that are dominated by disk emission. And over here, this is dominated by coronal emission, like Avery described from the sun, perhaps reconnection events. We're not sure, just hot electrons. So there's a rich library of behavior that we observe. But really what we're interested in fundamentally is just distilling down to, of course, two parameters, mass and spin. So somehow mass spin plus an accretion disk gives us this rich landscape. Again, to keep my observer hat on, I want to remind us just how it is that we detect these black holes in the first place. So essentially, the X-ray observer's job for finding black holes is rather simple. We wait. We wait for something to go bang in the night, and then one of several scanning X-ray detectors will hopefully send out an alert very quickly and tell everyone else, hey, go check this out. Something new appeared in the sky. And most of the time, 70% of the time or so, a new X-ray transient is a black hole. So we watch as a black hole goes through an outburst, which usually lasts for something like 6 months. And then when it fades enough, we can go and look for an optical counterpart, so a stellar companion. And when it gets very quiet, we can try to use the dynamics of that companion to measure mass. So that's what I'll show you about in just a moment. And roughly, we get a couple of these per year, although in the last 6 months or so, we've been lucky. We've had about five of these things happen quite recently. So things are hot right now. Hopefully that bodes well. I'm not sure. In any case, this is showing you the trajectory of GX339, one of the sort of most famous poster children of X-ray binaries. And this is what an outburst usually looks like in that same landscape of X-ray binary behavior. So what happens is a new X-ray binary goes off and usually rises in this hard state until it reaches some peak brightness, and then it switches over to a soft state. So again, this is dominated by emission from a corona, and over here, dominated by emission from a disk. So there's a transition that happens from coronal-dominated to disk-dominated, and then it cools, and this is the very long-lived phase that goes for many months usually, and then a transition back to a hard state, but at lower luminosity. So the disk seems to disappear, the corona dominates, and then it goes back to quiescence. So that's the characteristic outburst cycle. This is sometimes called a hardness intensity diagram, a Q diagram, a turtle diagram. This is a familiar plot for X-ray observers looking at these systems.
What are the gray dots represent?
So the gray dots are everything else from that earlier plot. So this is all 30 or so black hole sources observed by RXT. and this is showing you a single trajectory from an outbursting system. Okay, so I want to just say a little bit about how we go about measuring mass. So anyone who's seen a talk about measuring exoplanet masses, it's the same, but that's much harder than what we do, is the punchline. But the idea is quite simple. You know, we have a binary system. We have a test particle, a star, that's orbiting our black hole, which is usually 10 times more massive. So we just measure a radial velocity for that companion star. That's characteristically hundreds of kilometers per second, not the centimeters per second that exoplanet studies are trying to measure. It makes a beautiful sine wave that you can fit to determine. You measure a period and a velocity amplitude from that sine wave directly. And period and velocity uniquely give you this nice property called the mass function. This is a strict lower limit on how massive the compact primary object is. So this is a very useful quantity to be able to measure very simply from a radial velocity curve. If you can also measure the inclination and constrain Q here, the mass ratio of secondary to primary, then you're in business. You have a mass measurement. So that's quickly the name of the game. So I won't say much more about how we measure Q, but just to show you quickly how we measure inclination, the stellar companion is usually distorted into a shape that's completely filling its Roche lobe, or at least very close to filling its Roche lobe. And as a consequence of that, the very apex of that lobe is gravity darkened, and the far side of the star from that gravity darkened tip is actually gravity brightened. So it's further in the well, it's hotter, brighter. So as this shape rotates around to an observer, you see different sizes of the star. You see more area here at quadrature. And when it's face on, you see a smaller area and you see it darkened. And when it's here, you see it smaller but brighter. And as a consequence, you get twice per orbit periodic modulation. So these strange ellipsoidal light curves tell you something about the inclination of that binary system. You can imagine if I put this entirely face on, I see the same shape all the time. And if I make it perfectly edge on, then I get something with really strong modulation. So basically the ratio, the amplitude of this whole structure and then the difference in the secondary minimum to the primary minimum, those together give you a clean measurement of the inclination. So that's often how we go about doing this. Sometimes we have additional constraint from a jet or so on, but this is the usual way it's done. Okay, so that's essentially all I had to say about mass.
But this is measuring the inclination of the outermost part of the disk.
No, well, this is measuring the inclination of the binary orbit. Yes,
plane, right?
That's right.
So you're assuming for the inclination of the disk that it aligns with that?
Often, yes.
Often, not always.
Not always. So if you're measuring a jet, for instance,
yeah.
You know, the jet is not produced by the stellar companion. The jet is produced from the innermost disk near the black hole. So that we think is certainly telling us something about the spin axis of the black hole directly. But it is usually the case that we make an assumption that the binary orbit is aligned with the spin axis of the system. So the time scale for that should be something of order 10 to the 7 years, whereas most of these binaries are 10 to the 9 years old or so. That's not always the case, but roughly the time scale for alignment is about 1% the binary lifetime. Okay. So this is a quote you saw earlier today from Sam, but I wanted to put up the rest of it. Because, you know, this statement by Chandrasekhar that, you know, Kerr black holes are the most exciting thing in his career, you know, that's all well and good, but he really gets poetic at the end, you know, this shuddering before the beautiful, this incredible fact. So this is, I was glad to see this appear earlier, but, you know, this really just to impress upon all of us that mass and spin describing a black hole is just a crazy consequence of nature. It's really an exciting thing, and if Chandrasekhar was this blown away by this fact, then we should all sort of appreciate this is strong gravity here, right? So how is it that we go about measuring spin, this second most interesting quantity for these systems? Well, fortunately, we have lots of test particles in orbit about our black hole for these binary systems. They form this accretion disk. And a simple consequence of dynamics in GR is that there's a truncation radius. There's an innermost stable circular orbit that should truncate this accretion disk around the black hole. And as I tune the spin for a given black hole system, then that inner radius, that innermost stable circular orbit, changes by a factor of 6. If I go from non-spinning to maximally rotating, I go from 90 kilometers to 15 kilometers.
So Avery was showing this luminosity plot. Mm-hmm. It's arguing that you have a contribution from the ISCO all the way to the photon ring. What's the role of that in your assumption?
So I'll show a little bit more about that in a little bit, but the punchline is that's a very inefficient mode of accretion for Sagittarius star, for these kinds of black holes. In this case, this is considering generically a radiatively efficient disk, so something that is geometrically thin but optically thick. So in this case, you're dominated by emission from the disk, although I'll show you later when you allow for emission from the plunging material that in a millisecond or so will go from the inner edge to through the horizon. It makes a small perturbation, but essentially it's quite small.
So if you were to take a thick disk model like what Avery showed, it wouldn't change so much the estimate that you do?
Actually, if you had a thick disk model, it would change things significantly. So in general, what we try to do is restrict the data that we analyze to being well confined to that thin disk regime. So we,
do you know how well do you know that's a thin versus thick disk?
We know it roughly. So what we know is that for these stellar mass black holes, when they're a few percent of Eddington and more, they're dominated by radiation pressure in the inner disk. So our usual mode is that we, this is work that Ramesh Narayan did 10 years back or so. When you're above 10-30% of Eddington, then H over R is less than 0.05, 0.1. So the scale height of the disk compared to the radius, so your angle is less than about 0.1.
Okay, so then you're in the thin disk region.
Yeah, but of course, magnetic fields make everything messy, so this is sort of a bit contentious, but I would say there seems to be more consensus among the different MHD groups that this is robust even in the face of magnetic fields. I don't know if Avery would agree or disagree with that.
Well, the when you have efficient, I mean, when you have efficient efficient disks, yeah, they're typically thin. I think relatively recently that people have even been able to think about running. I mean, nobody runs thin disk simulations; they all run thin disk simulations.
An important distinction.
H over R 0.1 versus 0.01.
Oh, okay.
So this can get quite thin in practice if they can tool, but you can't fully resolve the MRI. The MHD turbulence within the disk is supposed to drive accretion unless you resolve the disk height. And that means once you get to very thin disk, it becomes very expensive. So understanding that transition is somewhat difficult, but I think it's relatively straightforward to see that an efficient, a regularly efficient disk does cool. And in fact, it's the other regime that is more extraordinary, the idea that you can have a disk that enormous amounts of gravitational binding energy are liberated and the thing doesn't cool.
So I'll show a little bit more about simulations weighing in on this in a few slides. But just to jump into it, so there, in terms of X-ray measurements of spin, there are really two techniques that we've been using now for a little over a decade. X-ray continuum fitting is what I'll describe first. This is where we're modeling black body-like emission by the accretion disk to measure that radius of the ISCO and determine spin. The other technique is the reflection method, often known as the iron line method because it's the most prominent reflection feature is this 6.5 keV iron line, where you're trying to model relativistic distortion of the line profile as a proxy to measure the extent of the innermost stable circular orbit. Of course, you will all know that gravitational waves are giving us now a very exciting new window on spin and many other things. But also, there are two other X-ray techniques that are on the horizon, if you will, of being used. So one is using X-ray quasi-periodic oscillations. So there are a number of systems that show sort of these very fast variation features in power density spectra. So this has some promise for near future use. And if we get an X-ray polarimeter in flight, and it looks like we will in the next 10 years, almost certainly, this will be another avenue to spin.
But we don't know what the QPOs are due to. Is that our element? Do we not know?
No, you're right. So what we're limited by right now is we have about five systems that have high-frequency QPOs where the QPO frequency is essentially commensurate with the Keplerian orbit at the ISCO. And we have probably a dozen models for producing those QPOs. So with 5 points and 12 models, you know, it's anyone's game. The hope is that we get enough data that can make strong rules on, strong constraints, rule out some of those models, rule in others, that this will eventually become the most precise means by measuring spin. Right now, that's not the case. Yeah. So first, continuum fitting. This was pioneered in 97 by Zhang, Shui, and Chen. What's nice about this method is it's incredibly simple. So the same way that we go about measuring the radius of a star that we can't resolve by taking advantage of the fact that it radiates like a black body, we just measure the luminosity and from a spectrum measure a temperature. We can put luminosity and temperature together to solve for an opening angle on the sky. And if we get a distance, like from Gaia, say, then you uniquely measure radius just by virtue of the fact that it's radiating like a black body. Well, for an accretion disk, the problem is completely analogous. You no longer have spherical symmetry, you have cylindrical symmetry, so you have a projection inclination to take into consideration. And rather than a single temperature black body, you have a black body profile, but those are boundary conditions. The problem is directly analogous. So if you have a flux measurement and a temperature measurement from a single X-ray spectrum, you can determine solid angle, and then with distance and now inclination to constrain the symmetry, you can measure the radius of the ISCO. But of course, radius has physical dimension, kilometers, and we're interested in spin, which is dimensionless, so we need to additionally take out the mass. So with a single spectrum in the X-rays, you measure flux and temperature, and if you also know distance, inclination, and mass, you determine spin. That's the name of the game. So the practical requirements for this are that we want a spectrum that's in a state dominated by that accretion disk emission. Now, earlier when I showed you that hardness intensity diagram, I highlighted there's a window in which the accretion disk dominates. So I'll show more of that later, but essentially that tells us where to look in order to go about making these measurements. And then we need theory to tell us what does that disk profile look like? What is temperature as a function of radius, essentially? And that's something that's been well known since the 70s. So this is Novikov and Thorne, Page and Thorne, 73, 74. And we use these alpha disk models as sort of the underlying structure for the accretion disk. So this is very simple theory. And we're essentially fitting data that looks like this, trying to measure two parameters, flux and temperature. So we measure a peak and an amplitude and put in a relativistic disk model, and that tells us spin. So the idea is quite simple, actually.
You might get into all the complications in the room if you were to shut up. But two quick questions. The first is, there was a long debate about the inner edge torque.
Yes.
And how much that could, and I think the answer ultimately was in some disks, it's 10%-ish of what you could have had and pretty close to zero. But at what point does that become a significant source of error for you?
So it seems like basically there are a range of effects that kick in at significant scale height. So basically H over R seems like a good proxy for things going wrong. And there was a lot of hope that we would have a good slim disk model that would rectify a lot of the effects and sort of bring things into alignment with thin disk measurements. And unfortunately, that has not been the case. So right now, the safest thing seems to be restrict yourself to when the disk is thin, and you can, and you have a reliable measurement. If you want to go to slim disks, then sort of here be dragons. You're not anchored anymore in solid models. So keeping things in the simplest domain as possible seems to be the right answer.
And the same question directly on this you have to make a quantization prediction, don't you?
Yes. Yeah. So this. For me, this very tedious power law out here is contaminating the disk measurement to some degree. So for Javier, who is the leader in reflection models, this is where the action begins, and I'll talk a little bit about that next. The thermal states that we're trying to use to measure spin in this case with the continuum fitting technique, we always have something like 90% or more of the emission coming in this thermal component. And then this Compton power law is something that of a nuisance parameter that we have to take away. And this is just due to hot electrons in a corona around the disk. It's always present, and we see it basically scatters away some of the disk emission. So this is something we have to include in our model.
But doesn't it also distort the disk temperature a little bit, which would then affect your radius reconstruction?
Well, what we do is we put in a convolution model that basically self-consistently Comptonizes all of the disk photons. So it does, in net, have a distortion effect, but that's accounted for in the model. And if it's just a few percent of the emission, then this distortion is well in hand.
Still, this is a vertical only model, right? That Shane had helped develop, isn't it?
A BH spec.
Yeah.
So this is actually this is using Kirby B, which has a color temperature correction. It's relating Kirby B to BH spec, where there is no Comptonization, and then we toggle that on after sort of a post-processing effect.
If you were to mess this up, how would it affect? Let's say if you were to take this quantum power law away, how would it affect your measurement? It would produce higher spins?
That's right. Actually, if you put in, we've explored putting in different models for this parameter and not doing things self-consistently. And if you put in just a power law component, you don't consider it Comptonization, you just say there's extra emission going on and put in a power law structure, then you'll recover a slightly higher temperature for the disk, lower normalization. Those conspire to give you a smaller or a higher spin, a smaller emitting area. Mm-hmm. And in general, for systems like this, where it's less than a few percent of the emission, 5% or so, it doesn't really change things appreciably, certainly not within your systematic errors. You might go from 0.5 to 0.55 or something, but that's well within the range of systematics. And I would say we've for the continuum fitting case, we've done a pretty careful job exploring these kinds of systematics on the whole by putting in different components for this, putting in different disk models, and allowing for the variation in mass, inclination, and distance.
Is it built anywhere in your model? Okay, that may seem crazy, but it is crazy. Is it built anywhere in your model that the spin has to be below Kerr?
Yes, only in the thin disk model that we're applying is derived. It assumes GR, so there's no solution if you want to push spin above one, it won't solve. What we can do in practice is put in sort of a dummy parameter. And we've tried this for like SIGX1, for example, that seems to have an extreme spin. There's a dummy parameter that you can let vary such that if it wanted to push to something that was a super spinner, you could let it do that in effect. SIGX1 happens to be fine with you pushing to a super spinner solution, but it doesn't demand it. Nothing that we've come across has a level of more than one sigma, say, wanted to be above the Kerr bounds.
But you could also go the other way around, right? So if I think of a different disk model, where actually is doing something like emitting from all the way to photon orbit, if you look at it from this angle, you may say, I'm looking at something that has very high spin, when in reality it may have much lower spin.
Yeah, it's true. If you give a completely different model for this, you can supply your exotic model and fit this, and see what it gives you, certainly.
So So the original Novikov and Thorne disks truncate sharply at the East Coast, but
that's right.
There's some spillover in real systems. Is that now accounted for in the modern disk models?
No. So I'll show you in a couple slides the magnitude of that effect, which is not very large. So one thing just to say it is, a lot of the emission from inside the ISCO, because these are thin disks, they're still sort of dynamically confined, a lot of that emission gets beamed directly into the horizon, so it doesn't contribute appreciably to the observer at infinity.
Jack, are you using NuSTAR to get the quantum power law?
More and more, yes. We love getting NuSTAR.
That must be really knocking
yours down. Oh, yeah, especially for reflection models. NuSTAR has been a complete game changer. So NuSTAR, for those of you who may not be familiar, is an X-ray telescope. It's the first focusing hard X-ray optics. Goes from 3 to 80 keV. And so it very good sampling of this. If you see, these disks typically peak around 1 keV or thereabouts. 3 to 80 gives you nice coverage of the disk and exquisite coverage of this power law component and reflection features. Yeah, it's been very excellent for that. So I'm going to show you now the punchline of how well this seems to work in practice. So the best test case that we identified for among the library of 30 or so black holes that have been well studied is LMCX3. So this is a kind of unique X-ray binary system in that it's persistently bright and it varies a lot. So SIGX1, the first discovered black hole, is sort of parked at a rather fixed brightness. And most of these persistent systems that we see all the time, they're very steady in luminosity. They don't show variation. LMCX3 varies all over the map, about three orders of magnitude in luminosity in total. So what we did was we took all of the well-calibrated data we could get our hold of, spanning a few decades, 8 instruments with very different characteristics. And when we restrict ourselves to this thin disk window where we trust our model, we find that we can measure the inner radius. It's very stable. So if I just consider within instrument variation, so say all the red points, it's about 2% variability. If I consider instrument to instrument variation, then it's 5% variability. So there's a constant inner disk radius that's recoverable in this system. So this was the strongest foundational evidence that you can go about the enterprise of measuring black hole spin. There's a fundamental radius. It's measurable with better than 10% precision. But is this actually the ISCO? That's the bigger question.
So that was the best case. Is there a worst case? Is there some cases?
Oh, well, there most cases we don't have hundreds of spectra and a lot of time. There are a few cases where we just have one observation or two observation, especially some of these older transients like A0620 that went off in the late 70s. That's something where we have sort of two good spectra that we can use to measure spin. And because this is so well anchored, this is sort of a proof of concept that we can trust those two measurements. But here we have, 700 or so data points to feel good about trusting those two. So now to say whether or not the inner radius is actually at that location of the ISCO, that's where we turn to theory colleagues who are running GRMHD simulations, something that looks like this. This is showing you a logarithmic scaling of density for a slice through the disk flowing onto the black hole. Now you might notice pattern waves coming out that looks like it's an outflow, not an inflow. That's just a sort of a barber pole phenomenon. But this is actually measuring the disk flowing onto the black hole. The ISCO is marked by that black line. And what we can do is take simulations like this, run by Bob Penna and others, and do post-processing to observe the disk that was producing that emission. And so in black here, solid curves, I'm showing you the Novikov and Thorne model that our data processing assumes is correct. And in dashed lines, you're seeing the output of the simulated observations of those GRMHD simulations. And you see that they don't match exactly. There's an offset. So this a couple of the earlier questions have been, what about emission inside the ISCO? What about torques and so on? So this is showing that, yes, we're making an incorrect assumption in applying Novikov and Thorne, but it's letting us quantify the degree to which we're doing badly. And it turns out that the degree to which we're doing badly is very small. So this is much smaller than any of our observational errors. So differences of order 0.01 in spin. And it turns out that this error is strong function of h over r. So if the disk scale height is very fat, becoming slim rather than thin, then it's worse. But when it's thin, I hate this term, slimness. It's but
By how much? I mean, now you say this is for basically a thin disk model, right?
That's right.
So this is 1% systematic. Now, if you were to have a slim disk, which
all
is
the simulations are slim disks. So the dash line.
Oh, sorry, sorry.
Yeah.
So slim disk is 0.01 h over r.
Slim is 0.1.
Okay.
Slim is fatter than thin.
Okay.
Well, I'm not so sure about
the study of the slimness, how it goes. So if I do 0.4, 0.2, 0.1, and then try to extrapolate, will those kind of layer arms go up or come down?
Yeah, so Akshay Kulkarni and Yuchang Zhu studied this, and so others in working with, Julian Krolik and his team, Jeremy Schnittman and so on, have also studied this a bit. It looks like as you crank up h over r, this gets worse. As you lower h over r, this comes closer to the black line. That's the punchline. So the observational, the message is, if you can get in that, the thinner the disk, the better this model works. But in any case, these are deviations an order of magnitude or so smaller than our the systematics that come in from mass, inclination, and distance uncertainties.
For which h over r do you start hitting the level of your systematic from other systematics, from experiments?
It depends a bit on the system, but I'd say probably of order 0.3 or something, just to ballpark it. So yes, very thin. Not slim.
So
yeah, so Yuchang had I think they assumed that it emitted on a dynamical time scale. They put in an entropy profile and have it cool to that on a dynamical time scale.
Okay.
And Yuchang had used Cloudy or one of these radiative transfer codes to compute the emission properly. So non-LTE assumptions were.
Oh, okay, right. But they also don't have all the non-thermal populations in there, right? So then, I guess my next question would be, which of these situations would you classify as your gold standard data set? Which would you identify as being, behaving badly and you wouldn't try to measure spin on? Do you have any capacity to assess that, given that they don't have corona in these situations? I don't think they do that.
So Yuchang did identify a corona in one of these simulations. So it's really, you sort of see what comes out after the fact. You don't
they
put it in.
They don't generate populations of
So I don't know the details, but Yuchang did have a non-thermal population in the plunging region. So there he found a strong, optically thin corona, essentially. Or you were getting a lot of power law emission from the plunging region, especially at high spin. So I guess I'm not up on the details of these simulations, but that's sort of the extent of it. I think Jeremy Schnittman and his group have done more work on the corona in their models, but yeah, that's the limit of my observer knowledge, I suppose.
So can I just understand? So for a given system,
mm-hmm.
the Eddington or the luminosity that you measure, can you infer what the thinness of the disk is? How accurate is that? So can you tell that you're in the regime where?
So in practice, what we do is we make sure that we're within 30% Eddington. Usually, that's what we typically take as the upper cutoff for this, because you're dominated by radiation pressure. So that's just sort of an empirical cutoff that we have imposed now for a while as sort of a measure to make sure that we're not pushing that regime too strongly. But we don't try to measure H over R. We don't try to correct for that within that below 30% window. In principle, we sort of had explored using these slim disk models to see if we could track that sort of evolution over a wider range of luminosity. But the outcome seemed to be that the best slim disk models that people were producing didn't reproduce the trends in the data very well. So we weren't. If we get a better model, we would love to use it. It would allow us to treat a wider class of sources. Right now, that's a limitation. So we just take the data in the window that we think it's most trustworthy. Yeah. So I guess the punchline of this being, there are corrections, but these corrections are quite small compared to our usual uncertainties. And this is just illustrating for you a typical kind of constraint that we can get. This is for LMCX3, where you see spin on this axis right here, and you see inner radius units up here. So you'll notice that the stretching of this looks quite odd. And of course, all of you here are interested in what is the spin. You're not interested in what is the inner radius. But really, this is the unit in which the measurements take place. This is really where the constraint is well behaved. So you see, if I take this shape and I shift it over here to high spin, you know, things would be very tightly constrained, you know, maybe 0.99 plus or minus 0.01 if it happened to be very high spin. But down here at low spin, because you know, a 10% change in radius or thereabouts maps to a very large range of spins, things scale nonlinearly. So that's an important thing to have in mind, is that whenever we're measuring high spins, we have tighter constraints. Whenever we measure low spins, we have broader constraints just by the nature of the measurement we're doing.
Jack, is it interesting that the posterior can get to negative regrade, basically,
yeah,
spins?
Yeah, so there's really been no compelling evidence for a retrograde system so far, but it certainly, there's nothing preventing it from happening. So there have been dynamical studies of black hole populations. Tassos Fragos is one person who's worked on this a bit. And you get something like 10% of the time, I think, these population synthesis studies get happily retrograde alignments for the binary system. So these should exist. Some fraction of a few percent of the binaries we observe are likely to have retrograde spin. But of course, over time, those retrograde systems will tend to spin up the black hole to zero and then become prograde. So we don't really have good evidence for it, but there's nothing fundamental that says it shouldn't be.
How about small spins? It's quite likely that the posterior will go.
Yeah, it goes all the way to minus 0.4 ish. Yeah.
How about the high spin regime? Do you restrict yourself to one larger than one?
Well, operationally, we can only fit up to one. But if anything is pushed to one, what we do is we put in this sort of proxy where we allow a dummy parameter to vary that sort of, and effectively, we allow the inner radius to squeeze inside of that when it goes to that limit to see, does anything really want to push far past one?
Yeah.
And so far, nothing has. So we've allowed it. SIGX1 is happy to push in, you know, to a spin greater than one, but it doesn't need it to get a good fit.
Does GRS 1915
Yeah, GRS 1915 is another one of these extreme cases. There it was not even pushing as hard as SIGX1 was. Oh. But so there's some, you know, the same way that you have this bell curve, some degree of that bell curve is happy with greater than one for GRS 1915, more of it for SIGX1. But there's basically nothing has demanded it to provide a good fit to the data, so there's no evidence for it. But it is something we can sort of explore by.
Because that would be an indication also for
new physics.
Well, for systematics.
You're right. Yes. Yes, you're. You were being chided by a theorist. That's right. Yes, you're right. It would first be an indication for systematics, certainly.
Some sort of systematic, yes. When you're measuring high speed where you should.
You're very right. Yes. So it is something that we've worried about for that kind of reason. So we've checked it, and so far nothing's pushed us there.
No object from the past rotating ones that wants to be like.
Yeah, nothing has demanded it.
Okay.
So at least so far, we'll see.
So if you said there was something that demanded it, what would your response
be? No, there would be some systematic in the method.
Yeah. Okay.
No. Yeah.
Just,
so that's
just
fine.
Yeah.
I don't know. No, we would search check for systematics.
Yes.
So suppose you find something that wanted to have spin above 1. Let's say it wanted to be 1.1. The first odd one, just barely odd, right? And then how much would you have to drop the mass by or change the inclination by before that was fine? And is that well within the kinds of range that you would consider reasonable?
So you know, roughly things go like cosine I, the inner radius scales linearly with mass in terms of the constraint, at least to first order, this is the case. So 10%, if it's pushing 10% in, 10% change in mass, 10% change in cosine I, or 10% change in distance.
If you found something that needed a spin of 10, you just assume you had the wrong state.
Well, I mean, we know what state we're in quite well. So if we found something with a spin of 10, we would be scrambling very hard to say something was funny. That would be a very big systematic.
But aren't all the errors you mentioned included in the posterior part of the distribution you showed?
Yes. So these sorts of things, this folds in all of our all of the systematics that we sort of have assessed: mass, inclination, distance, different accretion models, and uncertainty in the modeling of the non-thermal component. So all of that is sort of folded into this fat Gaussian that you see. Yes.
I'm sorry, what is the dotted line again?
The dotted line, this is just illustrating a particular choice of alpha. These are using an alpha disk model that's setting a viscosity prescription for the disk. So we explore a range of those. This is just illustrating one of them as a reference point. This is because I pulled it from a different talk. Okay, so that was really what I wanted to say about the continuum fitting method, and I'm going to say a little bit about the other method, the reflection or iron line measurement. So this is a more physically complex piece of analysis. So the thermal component I described before is just the emission directly from the accretion disk. But as I showed you, we have this non-thermal component, this Compton power law, that comes from thermal emission scattering in a corona of hot electrons. Characteristically, these seem to be roughly 50 to 100 keV in temperature compared to a disk that's about 1 keV. So we see that all the time. But in those hard states, this corona is dominating the spectrum. So what we know happens sometimes is that the photons coming from the thermal disk get scattered in the corona, and then that scattered emission returns to the disk and heats a surface layer of the accretion disk. That reprocessed emission then comes off, and it's what we call reflection. So again, thermal emission to the corona and back to the disk produces reflection. And this is the piece of physics that Javier in the back there is the world leader in producing these reflection models that are now really New Star's bread and butter for studying black hole X-ray binaries and AGN to measure spin. So the idea is that you have some power law of emission coming from a corona that illuminates the disk, and what you get out in the rest frame of the gas is this blue dotted line here. So many, many atomic features, transitions, and edges sort of carve out structure in the reflection component. But interstellar gas is the bane of X-ray observers, and it just cuts off everything essentially below 1 keV. It tends to go away due to interstellar absorption. So we're really left with something that's dominated by this line here, this iron K line, and then this bump over here produced by Comptonization of the high energy emission on the cold disk. So this is the Compton hump. So a Compton hump and an iron line are the main signatures of reflection. And just to give you an idea of what this looks like when we actually follow different annuli of the accretion disk inward. So when we produce these reflection models at different radii in a disk, when you go inwards, considering just line emission, you get this classic double horn profile. This is far out now, 400 RG. There's nothing relativistic to speak of. As you start going inwards, you get some asymmetry, and then you see the Doppler boost really kicking in around 30 RG, where this side is boosted towards you in intensity, and then the side moving away from you is deboosted strongly. When you go further in, you see the whole line profile shifts redward. That's gravitational redshift, of course. And it becomes extreme when you go to the innermost radii. So if you integrate this whole profile together over the disk, you get something characteristically like this, this very skewed red wing of a line. So this is was first observed for the iron line. And so this is often known as the iron line method. But of course, this Compton hump and all those other little atomic transitions that you saw in the earlier slide are subject to the same sort of distorted structure as well. But to give you a sense of this, I'm showing those same pair of black holes, the non-spinning and rapidly rotating black holes. And when I look at the difference in the extreme red wing of that iron line, you see that for the non-rotating case, it goes down from 6.5 all the way to about 4 keV. And in the case of the maximally rotating black hole, it goes all the way down to 1 keV or so, something. So this difference here in the red band, that's really what's letting us measure spin. So we fit this to emission in hard states where we see strong reflection features. And this is work done by Javier, where you see the highest signal reflection component that had ever been modeled. This is with RXTE, about 40 million counts in an X-ray spectrum, which is really exquisite data. And you see there's a strong line feature here, and then there's a Compton hump up here. So this is what the reflection model is trying to fit. And this is showing you that when we apply those greatest reflection models, those residuals disappear. So this goes away. And we can use the structure that best fits this profile as a measure of spin.
So now, how much can you okay, now the question of systematics here, because you
yes.
How much can you sculpt the line depending on how you fit? Because you have to subtract a background, right?
Yes.
So
it's a very important point, and I would say systematics have not been assessed nearly as carefully for iron line measurements as for continuum fitting. And if you change the continuum a little bit, because you're really trying to measure that subtle structure, it can have a significant impact. So I would say right now, there are a lot of sort of model limitations for how to apply this. Another very important limitation is the coronal geometry, which we really don't know at all observationally. And we can put in some rough constraints. Often we treat it just simply as a lamppost, so a point source on the spin axis illuminating a disk. Mm-hmm. We know that, in fact, this is capturing lots of photons and scattering it, so it can't be a lamppost. So, but you know, we can put in sort of make an assumption that it's a lamppost, or put in something that has to have an emissivity profile, like a broken power law. Mm-hmm. So there are different tricks that people do, but they're very simplistic tricks right now. And I think that's something that that has improved significantly, actually, in the last 3-4 years and is continuing to improve. But yes, the model for the continuum is equally important in setting the shape of that red wing, and something that we need to have well in hand to get reliable spin measurements out. So with that as sort of the backdrop for those methods, just to give you a sense now of these spins in overview, I want to just remind you this, again, characteristic pattern for an outbursting black hole transient, and now point out that in these red points over here are in that hard state where the reflection is best observed. And over here in this purple state over here, this is where the thermal disk is dominating. So a single transient, what's nice is that nature gives us transient phenomena that in human timescales give us data in both ends. So we can wait until it gets into a nice bright hard state over here, measure spin with reflection. Then a couple weeks later, it'll be over here in a thermal state at low enough luminosity that we can apply our thin disk model, get continuum fitting constraints. So we just have to wait, select the right data for the right method, and we can generally get good measurements for both techniques, as long as the source cooperates and as long as we have the right missions taking data to fit those models. So this is a landscape for you of roughly 24 measurements now of spin for black hole binary systems. Something that I didn't stress is that, well, for continuum fitting, we need to know the mass to get spin. The big advantage for the iron line and reflection technique is that it's mass agnostic. So you don't need to know mass at all. That's not helpful for you guys, but in terms of just assessing black hole spins, this is really important.
Can you explain that measurement that says for GX339-4, the iron line is either 0.3 or larger than 0.3?
Yeah, so this is a case where we were trying to assess systematics by putting in a layer of physics that does comptonization of the reflection emission in the corona that produces it. This is detail that you probably don't want to know. And there's bimodal solutions. So there was one solution at low spin and one solution at extreme spin.
But then on that, why is it not, there is no other case in that column that would show the same? It's because you haven't done this exercise?
Yeah, this was done last year. And it has not been done.
This just extrapolate to all other ones that could be this bimodal?
Well, I guess I would be surprised if they're all bimodal, but I expect that there is some systematic impact of this on all of these, but probably at a relatively modest level. It's possible some of these other ones will turn out to be bimodal as well, but this is where systematic, I think, concerns are more an issue for iron K than for continuum fitting. The big systematic for continuum fitting is the assumption that came up earlier of alignment between the spin axis and the binary plane, which affects a lot of these. So probably buried in here, there's one or two systems that has some appreciable misalignment. We have to just rely on the fact that as a population, that's unlikely.
So there are at least for the AGF case, there are all kinds of things that people are doing now that, at least to me, make me more confident, like reverse iron line reverberation. That's very difficult. Is that something that you can do in the stellar mass situation? Would that provide confidence regarding these sorts of systematic questions?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's a very good one. So this is a very fast time-dependent analysis of basically as a function of frequency, you can look at what, the spectrum is a function of timing frequency, and you can essentially measure phase lags as a function of energy to see that when you get an iron peak that's lagged with respect to the rest of the spectrum, meaning it's further in the potential well, so you can sort of trace that line shape in time space as well. That's what Avery's describing. So I'm actually part of a new mission called NICER that just went up on the space station that's the premier X-ray timing instrument, and that's one of the things we're trying to do is do some reverberation for binaries. So typically that's been challenging, and it is still challenging with NICER, but we're starting to do some of that, yes.
But it would also nail down the continuum line degeneracy, right? Because the continuum is going up and down, however it goes up and down, but the line is always coming from deep in, so the time delays between the... Well, the Comptonizing continuum and the emission of the iron line fluorescence line will tell you essentially where it is, breaking the degeneracy, where the emission comes from, and that's what energy.
So I think in principle, yes. In practice, there are complications. There's reprocessing timescales in the outer layer of the disk, which I think is relatively short. I can't remember for certain if it's short enough. And you also get dilution of your, if you had just reflection emission, just an iron line being emitted, then it would be simple. But you have a continuum that dilutes the time lag as a function of energy, so you end up with these sort of sweeping structures through. So it's more complex than sort of a simple analysis would suggest. But it is important and an independent kind of diagnostic, and we're starting to do some of that.
There's no continuum determination for so many of them because you said it's kind of more straightforward. So
well, the problem is that we need mass information to do the continuum fitting constraint. So we're trying to get more data. The fact that NuSTAR has come online means it's doing a fantastic job getting us reflection measurements, but we haven't done the ground-based analysis quickly enough to catch up. Usually the mass measurements that we do are ground-based optical and infrared spectrographs and so on.
So the ones in blue, why are they?
Oh, yes, sorry. So I highlighted just because your eyes are probably scanning looking for comparisons.
Yeah.
I picked the ones highlighted in magenta if they're in good agreement between the methods. And in blue if they're of questionable agreement between the methods.
But I missed.
Yes, this is my fault. This was supposed to be on GX339.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Yes.
But that one, why does it have a star there next to 0.7?
Yeah, this was because it was a very early measurement. The error bar here is not a
question. It's questionable.
Yeah, this
have
is.
Have you reanalyzed the data?
Yes, off roughly, and the error bar is about 0.15 or something. If you do it more properly.
Ah, okay, then it's not.
Things shifted slightly, but not within this precision. Yeah, it's still 0.7.
So you mentioned earlier the age of the system. Can you say a few words how the determinant for how?
So most of these we don't really have a good age of the system. So some other work by Tassos Fragos has from I think 2015. There's some really interesting work where he used MESA to ask the question: Can these systems have accreted their spins? And so for the Roche-Loeb overflow transient systems, not the ones that have very massive companions and are wind-fed, but most of these systems, the answer was yes. So just by looking at the temperature of the companion star, the period, and the spin, it looked like there was, with running these sort of binary population synthesis models, he was able to say, this matches with this kind of model, this matches with this kind of model, and there was enough mass exchange between those binaries that matched to account for spin-up from a sort of natal non-spinning core. The only one that was very challenging to do that with was 1915. There, I think, he fell short. He was able to get it to 0.9. It's a very long period system, rather than 0.98 or some very extreme spin. But
that Cygnus is also hard to find.
So SIGX1 is one of the persistent systems. That was not one of the transients that he was modeling because it's a different class of source. So it has a 20 solar mass companion, and it's not Roche-Loeb overflow. It's quite young. It's being fed by the wind of its companion star.
So it cannot be spun up by the companion? It's burst spin mostly for Cygnus?
So very roughly, I would say that we have evidence, I would say, that the transient population, actually, let me skip ahead, close your eyes, you're not supposed to see these slides yet. Yeah, okay, so very roughly, pre-LIGO, what I would have said to you is that all of the high mass systems with high mass stars, they tend to have high mass black holes that also have high spin. And these spins have to have been imparted at birth because there simply isn't time enough for them to have accreted sufficient mass to be spun up. So all of these are within just a few million years old because they have a time bomb in their stellar companion that will go boom before they can accrete enough mass to spin up. But all of the rest of these systems are transients that are just on for short periods of time and then go into quiescence. And all of these ones seem to be consistent with having accreted their spins. Doesn't mean they had to be born with no spin, but it's at least a consistent picture. Again, with 1915 stretching that a little bit. So that's the story.
So how many of these do you have radio imaging of ejections? So I know SS-433 is not on the list,
yeah.
But you know, that's some system that shows clear evidence for precession at the time.
Yeah, and so none of these shows evidence for precession in the jet. This is kind of interesting. So 1550, where is it? Here, and 1655. Juris 1915, 4U1543, B404. So a lot of these we have seen. We've seen jets come off of these systems. We have observed those jets over, in some cases, several years, and we haven't seen corkscrew patterns in the jets, at least that we can resolve. So nothing has looked like an SS-433 of this population. That would certainly be indication of misalignment if we did see it. And SIGX-1 actually has a large radial bubble, and we see small-scale jets. It looks like it has sort of consistent with it having a very low proper motion, that it seems like it was kind of a silent collapse to a black hole. So roughly, many of these systems, we have information on radio jets.
So
trying to go back to the distribution of spins that you guys see, I mean, these have an intrinsic bias to favor higher spin as opposed to low spins because it would be brighter? Because just, I'm trying to, from there, there's a tension with light.
In this case, no, because any black hole that went off in the galaxy, we would see. If it had a spin of -1, so that the ISCO is largest, we would see it simply because when they go off, they tend to reach Eddington luminosity, which at kiloparsec distances is just so bright that any detector would see it.
So, but from the table that you had before, I mean, you seem to have more 0.5 and above.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'll go back. That's right. Yeah, so what I would say is it just seems like nature has given us prograde black holes that have a wide range of spins, but the if you draw a midline or something, above 0.7 seems to be sort of the 50-50 cut or thereabouts.
And that's in tension with LIGO's.
Say what?
It's in tension with LIGO's observation.
So it is very interesting. The LIGO sources are all, they're much more massive black holes, and they seem to be non-spinning black holes. This is very interesting.
It's an axiom that we say it's new physics.
But you're not talking about the individual ones. But this is the spin along the orbital angular momentum.
But
you have anything on the plane, but
so
you're seeing it along the orbital.
This is a super special subset of potential
black holes
out there. And LIGOs are a super duper special subset.
Yeah.
Not so much.
In a good way.
So.
And they perform supposedly through the same mechanism.
Let me throw a piece of speculation at you. So if these, LIGO certainly is most likely to detect systems in dense environments, right? That's where you have the most likelihood of getting a close enough binary system that can harden rapidly, that can merge. And as we know from the explanation usually for why we don't see black holes in globular clusters in the Milky Way is that they get kicked out. So if you have a merger system that produces a progenitor black hole with some appreciable kick, then if it's more than 1,000 kilometers a second, then it's gone, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it could be that LIGO, what we see with LIGO is preferentially those black holes that did not get, that had low spin, so they didn't get a large kick, so they were retained, so they merge with low spins. That's a possibility. I'm enormously interested in why this is. I think it's very exciting, but I don't have a good answer for you, but I have been thinking about it.
There's an axiom.
An axiom. Yes. They've spun down. and it certainly could be that, there's a systematic offset to all of these, but I would say the fact that we have something, we have measurements at essentially zero and at essentially one means that we aren't likely to have some large devastating single systematic that shifts everything into chaos. It could be that everything gets lowered by 0.1. I'd be surprised if anything shifted by more than that, really. But yeah, certainly there's room for systematics to move these around.
Has there been any effort to simulate some kind of mock data for you guys to run your analysis pipeline on? I could imagine a good simulation coupled to some post-processing, maybe add some noise into the X-ray counts, and especially this way you could, for instance, simulate retrograde disks and other things that you maybe don't expect.
Well, I guess the best kind of simulated data that we've really wrangled with is from GRMHD simulations, where we were trying to look for the deviations from Novikov and Thorne. I don't think that's been done in the same kind of way for reflection. I don't know, Javier, if you know.
If I guess what you're asking, I think, yeah, that, actually the work we did in simulating, there have been works in trying to assess how well reflection models can recover parameters.
Yeah.
And the short answer is yes, there's been some work done, but it's still not conclusive because it's quite tricky. There are many parameters in the genesis, and it depends a lot on how you fit. What we found is that we could simulate a bunch of data with different parameters, and then if you start your fit too far off from the solution, then the algorithm will wander off in other solutions, and you'll never recover anything meaningful, mm-hmm. but it still give you a good fit. Because, you know, by just by coincidence of changing parameters around, you might be able to. That's sort of what I'm worried about.
What if you get a retrograde disk and it fits, and you get a great fit for a prograde nearly extremal?
I think that this, the answer to that is simple, because there's a huge difference between,
yeah.
you know, something that is retrograde, something that is maximum spin. You'll never make it work.
Yeah.
The problem is where, you know, you have more, you know, more of a closer solutions
yeah.
where you have a maybe intermediate spin, and then, you know, you can vary other parameters, like the contribution of the continuum to the reflection, things
mm-hmm.
like that,
mm-hmm.
where your signal might not be, you know, as good to constrain things.
So I would say that, so this was really looking at sort of the performance of reflection models in a statistical sense, but it wasn't saying, like, taking a simulated model or simulated data from a more complex structure and fitting it with a, you know, the reflection models that are like more simplified, making approximations.
Does experimentalists essentially do this for AGM? I thought there was an industry of MHD simulators doing Ironman and you know, trying to assess systematics, including things like what happens if you have gas inside the ISCO and all of that.
Chris, you're right. Chris did do a paper. I only know of one paper from about, I guess it was about 10 years ago, where he did look at the effect of plunging gas inside the ISCO affecting the iron line from MHD simulations. That's right. But I don't know of...
That's one of his sets of expertise.
Yeah.
So surely he's doing something with it.
I haven't seen you know, more sophisticated simulations treated with reflection. I think one of the things is reflection models are necessarily, you know, they're coupling three components, and one of them you don't have a good model for what it is, where it is. I mean, putting magnetic reconnection, if it's important, into a GRMHD model is, you can appreciate more than me, an impossibility, right?
Nobody does that.
Right. So I think it hasn't been done well for reflection. And for continuum fitting, I think the simplified case of the sort of simulations like I showed you, that's essentially all we've explored. So I guess I do want to put up this quick comparison and run through, and then I'll get to my conclusions. You know, we're over time. So just to run down very quickly, both methods, the continuum fitting and reflection techniques, are both anchored, to remind you, in measuring that ISCO parameter. One's using thermal emission, one's using line features. They're measured in different states. Continuum fitting is really relegated just to stellar mass black hole systems because they peak in the X-ray domain. The thermal emission from AGN systems peaks in the UV, which is more complicated for a host of reasons that I won't get into. But importantly, reflection measurements work for both AGN and stellar mass black holes. The complexity for continuum fitting is relatively low. It's just thermal emission from a disk with some plasma corrections. This is really its biggest advantage, whereas the reflection model has to do with the geometry of the corona respect to the disk. It's a lot more intricate. The downside to continuum fitting is that we need to know mass inclination and distance independently. And we do have to make this cut to restrict ourselves to the thin disk regime just operationally. If we get a better model, that would be lovely, and we could sort of drop that restriction. As I said before, for the reflection method, we need to know something about impose structure for an unknown coronal geometry and make some assumptions about how the disk radiates. The systematics for continuum fitting are relatively well explored, and they're of order 0.1. And for the iron line, it's much more poorly explored, but probably of the same kind of caliber, 0.1 or thereabouts. So I'll skip these other small topics and just say, so right now we're measuring spin with two techniques. They seem to be consistent with each other to roughly about 2 sigma or thereabouts. The strongest foundation right now for all of these measurements is an enterprise, is that very stable inner radius with LMCX3 being the best case of finding that constant inner radius. So we've measured roughly 24. We're hoping to about double it, and we're working to improve our methods with get higher precision. And if anyone's interested in the reflection technique in particular, I would encourage you to talk to Javier, who's the leading expert on that. Thanks.
So by near future, what do you mean near future?
Well, I'd say, you know, something like 5 years, thereabouts, maybe 10 years, we can double the number of continuum fitting spin measurements. And NuSTAR and now NICER in operation together are great for going after these black hole systems, getting the right data we need for continuum fitting and reflection studies. So I think the limiting factor for continuum fitting would be getting masses from ground-based data. Oh, and if you want to see 10 full information on 10 black holes, this is everything you could know and would want to know about 10 black hole systems. But yeah, so right now, strangely enough, it's actually easier to get spin given NuSTAR than it is to go after the masses.
Jack, is it the case that NICER and NuSTAR decide to find new stuff, they will reanalyze existing constraints to make them better? Is that happening too?
So not NICER and NuSTAR per se, although some of these systems, yeah, I mean, most of them you have to wait for an outburst and then you collect your data and then you analyze it over time. A few of them are recurrent, and so it is the case that NICER and NuSTAR will give us new data on a couple of the more well-studied systems. But mostly what's happening is that we're using new, better quality data with higher signal and over a range of states to improve the underlying models that we then go back and reanalyze things. And I would say most of the sort of developments in model are happening on the reflection side, that because the model is more complex. In continuum fitting, it's been a much more sort of stable process for how those results go.
Yeah, so LIGO has done searches for continuous waves from Scorpius X1 in the hope that the angular momentum that's raining down on the star is also being shed in some sort of balance with gravitational waves. It's fairly expensive to go after a particular binary source. It's expensive computationally and also in analysis time. We have not gone after any black hole binary systems because, well, we didn't expect there to be any gravitational waves coming from continuous gravitational waves coming from those. But if we were to go after them on the assumption of super radiance, we'd want to know what the most promising sources are, and presumably those would be lowish spin, close to us.
Yeah.
And we also would want as much information about the system as we can get. That would be the orbital period, of course, the modulation depth, and in particular the modulation depth and the velocity of the black hole, because we can make corrections, Doppler corrections for its motion. And so I don't have a good sense of how often these things are timed and
I can. Yeah, I can tell you the best source without question would be A0620 for that purpose. So it's about the closest black hole. It's just a little over a kiloparsec away. The spin is very low, and its period has been measured for several decades. In fact, it was used recently to constrain the size of these curled up dimensions because of the stability in the period. So P and P dot are known to some high significance.
No, wait, if the spin is low, doesn't that mean that he has already lost
if it's high spin, then that means it can't have spun down because it's a gradient. If it's low spin, it's already spun down,
yeah,
but it may still have a cloud around it.
Right.
There's a different time scale for the cloud to
disappear.
You
need to see if there's compatible mass such that spinning down to this kind of spin is still allowed with all the other black holes.
Exactly, yes.
So that's the estimate you want to do.
So related question. So Cygnus X1 probably doesn't have a axion disk, and so the fact that it exists is explanation is because it's binary, and so the binary is disrupting its formation.
I mean, they're different things. So if for a given, so this is the exclusion that Savas was showing in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
So given a spin, you exclude a range of axion masses, and that includes the effect from the disruption. So at the very low end, the reason why you don't place a constraint is because you could have a disruption effect, or you could have the time that it would take the cloud to grow is too long compared to, say, the typical age of the binary or the fusion rate. So given a high spin measurement that excludes a range of masses. So you'd have to check, like Robert was saying, if you want to go after a similar mass black hole, that might not be the best thing, because it would be hard to, you know, you,
for them to be
yeah.
possible for one to be spun down and the other not to be spun
yes.
down.
Thank
yeah.
you.
So I guess what would be most useful for you to constrain this is low mass and high spin would put the strongest.
I mean, high spin.
The range of masses and high
spin.
Yes.
Yeah, high spins, no matter the mass, constrain a certain range of masses as long as you have a good handle on the history.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the problem with AGNs is that. There is no good handle on the mass and there's no good handle on the history, so it's very hard to say, even though they may be highly rotating, whether or not...
So what do you mean the history?
The history meaning how old the system is, when was the last time, especially for supermassive black holes, when was the last time that they think like a neutron star fell into the black
mm-hmm.
hole?
Well, it's not so big of an issue, right?
Eh?
It's not so big of an issue because of the Dipole thing. But yeah, if you had a big
no,
merger,
but if you fall, if you... If
yeah,
you
if you had a
first.
You had a violent merger, for example, recently, they might not have had time to build up the cloud.
Okay, so how does that time scale change with mass? I know
so
it was...
So if you fix a level, so it, as Sam and others were showing this morning, for the first level, it scales at, if you fix the mass of the particle, it scales as the mass of the black hole to the 9th power.
Wow,
so
okay, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So if I look at the plot, the prime black hole at the bottom of the list seems to be very similar to the second from the top on tangent, GROG1655.
Yeah.
So the masses seem to be very close, but the spins are quite different.
Yeah.
So, any comments?
So the period for this guy is this is an 8-hour period, and I think it's about a 3.5-day period for 1655. So a story that
what's the companion?
For the binary system, the orbital period. Yes. So the story that would make sense of this is that over time through binary mass transfer, you've put more mass from the companion star onto the black hole in this case, which has spun it up and expanded the binary over time.
But from the point of view of existence of an axion cloud, it seems that the binary with a longer period has much milder conditions towards forming the cloud than the binary that is tighter, which would imply that A0620 probably is not the best system to look at.
Yes.
Because
if Irshut had,
then GRO would have had it as well.
Yeah.
And so then I would have said that's probably...
Yeah.
Unless there's some other mechanism that would...
That's right.
So you have to check the parameter space that's allowed by the rest of the measurements and make sure, but I suspect because they're really, I mean, depends on the masses, yes, exactly. So they're similar mass, so probably the fact that that's there excludes some part of the parameter space, but it's not extremely spinning, so you may imagine that depends on where it sits on that plot of mass versus...
But also it still depends a lot on the age, right?
Yes,
because
of course.
One is much younger than the other.
Yeah.
Because that low value of the spin, it takes a long to spin down there.
Yeah.
Well, so on this side of things, where they start off lower and they're spinning up, this would essentially create a ceiling, right? So they can spin up to some equilibrium value, and then if they try to push up, then they'll just...
Right, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Is 0.7 above?
What?
0.7 is the bulk.
It depends on the particle mass.
It depends
okay.
on the particle.
Oh, I see.
So actually, tomorrow, we'll do this tomorrow sometime, after in one of the breaks. We'll show you a more detailed plot because Savas showed like a range of masses that was excluded. Masha or Robert, they can show you a more detailed plot that shows the exclusion and shows which object excludes what, which range. So that's what we can do tomorrow at some during the
breaks. Yeah, I think it'll be very interesting to go after what Keith's saying, say, try to figure out, given the existing constraints, which are the best objects
to
go
to
after,
time,
and we can all discuss, you know, given how well they're measured and so on.
Yeah.
Okay.
Definitely.
That'll be useful.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, that's thank James again.
Yeah.